From NPR News, this is special coverage of the 2016 election. I'm Ari Shapiro, a nail biter, a squeaker. The presidential race has the country on edge tonight as the results continue to roll in.
I'm Rachel Martin. So far, Donald Trump has outperformed expectations, widening his path to the presidency, and Hillary Clinton has struggled to keep up.
Trump has won several important swing states tonight, Ohio, North Carolina, and Florida. He's picked up Georgia, and he's running ahead in Michigan and Wisconsin.
As it stands right now, Trump is leading the Electoral College 238 to 209.
The night has also favored Republicans in other key races. North Carolina's Richard Burr keeps his Senate seat, as does Wisconsin's Ron Johnson.
Democrats did pick up a seat in Illinois, but their hopes of gaining control of the Senate are shrinking.
We are examining all the results as they come in and adjusting the math. Stay with us.
We've got NPR Sue Davis in the studio with us now. Sue, break down where we're at right now.
You know, at this point in the evening, it seems to be Wisconsin, Wisconsin, Wisconsin. Donald Trump is leading there right now with more than three quarters of the vote in. And a win there may certainly be a blockade to Hillary Clinton winning the White House. I cannot overstate how significant a Donald Trump victory in Wisconsin would be. The Associated Press, which we are going by, has not yet called Wisconsin, but he is certainly in the lead there. One very good sign for Republicans there is incumbent Republican Senator Ron Johnson won re-election to a second term in an upset win. He was heavily favored across the board to lose re-election tonight, and he won that seat. Democrats so far in the Senate have only net gained one seat tonight. That is a very poor showing for them when they were anticipating gains of 4 to 7 seats by most election forecasters heading into Election Day. And in the House, Democrats have picked up just two seats. What it looks like tonight is we are seeing a Republican wave sort of starting to crest, and we just don't know how high it's going to go yet.
Republican wave is not a phrase that people anticipated they would be using tonight.
Absolutely not. And part of what is stunning tonight is it's clear that the polling in so many of these races was inaccurate, or it was not a reflection of who was going to show up. There's been some disappointments for Democrats in terms of turnout, and the vaunted ground game we've heard so much about did not come through for Democrats. And it is surprising in that, you know, this was not expected to be as big of a Republican year as it is proving to be at midnight.
Even, Ron, Republicans themselves seem caught off guard by what's happening right now.
I must say, the observation that many of us had made in the last 2 or 3 days was that with the all-clear signal from James Comey regarding the investigation of the most recently discovered emails from Hillary Clinton's private server, and then with a turn in the polls, which was quite evident on Monday and Monday night, and which then heartened the markets, which had been drifting downward since they were worried about a Donald Trump win over the last couple of weeks, suddenly rebounded with their biggest jump in a very long time across the board, all the various indices, and a sense that generally suffused Democrats that everything was going to be all right. And Republicans were making the kind of noises you hear from people who are looking to start to distribute the blame, talk about how the Republican establishment hadn't really backed Trump, and that was why the party was divided.
And be a vocal opposition.
And then just essentially talking as though they were ready to put together their explanations and move on, expecting to come up short in the Electoral College and in the popular vote tonight. And although we don't really have anything approximating a final figure in the popular vote, the distribution of Donald Trump's vote has proven to be absolutely beyond what anyone might have projected.
To go big picture for a minute, the narrative I had been hearing for the last 4 years or more was, if the GOP wants to win big national presidential elections, they will have to appeal to Latinos, they will have to appeal to women, they will have to appeal to millennials. Along comes Donald Trump and does none of the above, and apparently outperforms Mitt Romney from 4 years ago in all kinds of ways. What's going on?
One has to say that the offensiveness of Donald Trump to, among others, Latinos may have been somewhat overstated. In the exit polls, and these are just exit polls, that's all they are, they're not absolute, but in the exit polls, Donald Trump is getting about 30% of the Latino vote. Now, of course, that's a minority vote, but 30%, not 10 or 15.
Mm-hmm. That's better than Mitt Romney did.
And it's making a huge difference in states like Florida, states like North Carolina, Ohio even. particularly, it's going to make a difference in some of these other states the Democrats had been expecting to do better in. And earlier in the evening, it looked like it was really going to help Hillary Clinton a lot. In the end, it didn't help nearly enough.
Sue Davis, you've got an update.
Another battleground state has been called for Donald Trump. He has won Iowa and its 6 electoral votes, bringing his tally now to 244 to Hillary Clinton's 209. He is now just shy of 30 votes to win the White House.
We're going to go now to Rick Pluta of Michigan Radio, who has been covering politics in Michigan for many years. And Rick, when tonight began, I don't imagine you thought that the presidency could hinge on your state.
No, it was a bit of a surprise, although we were not expecting that Michigan would be a battleground. That typically early in the election cycle, Republicans talk about trying to win Michigan, but then it doesn't work out that way.
So what happened differently this time?
That apparently Donald Trump's message about trade deals, about, you know, what was happening with the establishment versus the people who feel like the economic recovery isn't including them, has taken hold. And it's competitive. Now, Michigan is not a state that has gone with Trump yet, that people here are cheering because we're seeing that apparently Wisconsin has, at least one of the networks is called Wisconsin. And so people are feeling hopeful about that. But Michigan isn't there yet. But we have seen Republicans sweep the congressional races here, that Republicans have retained control of the state legislature here. And so people here are at this particular party, Republicans are feeling hopeful that it's going to go all the way up to the top of the ballot.
We should say the Associated Press has not yet called Wisconsin, and we're waiting on their call. In terms of waiting on Michigan's call, what parts of the
state has, but a lot of other news organizations have not.
What parts of the state in Michigan are you looking at to see where the results might be headed?
We have been looking a lot at suburban Detroit, especially Oakland County, where it was perceived that maybe Trump's message was turning off moderate Republican voters. And at least based on what we're seeing in the state legislative and congressional races, that has not been the case. And then there's always the bellwether of Macomb County, home of the Reagan Democrats, and whether or not they are going to come home to Republicans, whether or not they believe that Trump's message appeals to them.
Having covered Michigan politics for as long as you have, how does what you're seeing tonight look to you? Or how surprised are you?
You know what? In many respects, it defies expectation that we expected that. Can you hear the people behind me right now?
I do, yeah.
This is a very, very excited group. That Michigan has typically been home to moderate Republicans who were turned off by the sort of messaging that we've been hearing. But at the same time, we saw in the primary season back in March that Bernie Sanders won Michigan over Hillary Clinton. That defied the polls. That surprised everyone. Donald Trump won, and not a lot of more moderate alternatives. And now we're seeing whether or not that is going to play out to the nth degree here in the final hours of this presidential campaign.
Rick Pluta of Michigan Radio, thanks for joining us.
A pleasure.
We're going to switch gears now and move to the state of Pennsylvania, also a tight race, one that Hillary Clinton must win if she is to find a path to the White House. We're joined by Dave Davies of member station WHYY. Dave, what is it looking like from where you are?
Very, very close, with about 92% of the vote in. Donald Trump has a 20,000 vote lead. That's about 0.4 percentage points. He could actually win the state for the first time any Republican would have carried it in 26 years. And I've been trying to figure out what happened here. It looks like Trump performed about 2% better than Mitt Romney in Philadelphia, but the Clinton turnout machine seems to have been pretty robust. Clinton will get a 430,000 vote or so margin in Philly. Huh. And it also appears that Clinton did pretty well in the suburbs. But if you look at these rural counties, I'm seeing Trump running 8 to 12 points ahead of where Mitt Romney did 4 years ago. I mean, this guy connected with people in the conservative parts of the state in a way that really inspired a lot of passion, it seems.
Do we know, Dave, were many of these people first-time voters?
Can't tell, really. Mm-hmm. And I can't tell yet by looking whether the actual raw numbers are going to be higher than they were 4 years ago, because not all of the vote is counted. But what I am seeing are different margins. I mean, he really romped in these conservative areas.
When you talked with conservatives there, Trump supporters, what did they tell you about what they liked about him?
Well, as in with so many others, I mean, it's much more what they don't like about Hillary Clinton. Too much of the same. They see her as corrupt and dishonest and not for herself. And so they've gone to Trump. Some fully embrace Trump. I mean, they say he's, you know, a businessman, somebody who says it like it is. Many don't think he'll get everything he promises to do, but they're so frustrated with, you know, the economic dislocation that has cost jobs and income here that they really want to change.
There were some key down ballot races in Pennsylvania too, right?
Well, the big one was a U.S. Senate contest where Pat Toomey, a one-term Republican, was running uphill. In Pennsylvania, you have like 900,000 more registered Democrats than Republicans, so they tend to come out in a presidential year, so that made it tough for Toomey. He has done a fine job of presenting himself as a more pragmatic, moderate guy who tacks to the middle. He worked with West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin on background checks and made the most of that. He got Michael Bloomberg to endorse him and Gabby Giffords. And again, I think Trump's performance, particularly in the conservative areas, really brought out a lot of conservative voters. That race still too close to call. It's right about where the Trump race is, but it appears that Toomey may hold on to a seat, the Republican.
Another nail biter in Pennsylvania, Dave Davies of member station WHYY. Thanks so much, Dave.
Sure thing.
Ron Elving is with us here in the studio. And Ron, you know, the evening began with a report from Texas that George W. Bush and Laura Bush had cast their votes and did not vote for Donald Trump for president. So here is a Republican nominee who did not have the support of the last two Republican presidents, George W. Bush or George H.W. Bush, did not have the support of the last two nominees, Mitt Romney or John McCain, did not even have the full-throated support of the House Speaker, Paul Ryan. And yet, he now seems to be on the path to the White House. How did this happen?
It may be that all of those Republicans you just cited, by not supporting Donald Trump, in a sense, helped him, because they reinforced the narrative that seems to have resonated for Donald Trump.
That this was a vote for change.
This was a vote for change, not just a change from Barack Obama. Actually, the exit polls are showing us that of the people who voted today, 54% of them approve of the way Barack Obama is holding or handling his job. So this is not, directly speaking, a rejection of Barack Obama's presidency per se.
Anti-Washington
it's
at large.
Anti-Washington. And as some people have said, these voters want a chance to punch Washington in the face. And whatever else you want to say about Donald Trump, he is a punch in the face.
You know, this actually reminds me, when I was in Western North Carolina speaking with Trump supporters about what they liked about him, they said it was the very bull in the china shop quality. The fact that he was so unpredictable, the fact that he would just go in and break things, although they used a more vulgar word than things, that was what appealed to them about him.
Yes, and that's fine as long as it's someone else's china shop. But if it's Washington, D.C., and if he is going to go off and do battle against the rather ill-defined notion of what Washington, D.C. is, then people are okay with that. But tomorrow and next week and after January 20th, Inauguration Day, they're going to be dealing with Donald Trump as their president, and the China shop will be their country.
And so if you are that GOP infrastructure that every previous Republican president and leader has depended on, so much of which opposes Donald Trump, what do you do? Where do you fit in a potential Trump presidency?
Let's put it this way. Many of the Republicans, including Paul Ryan, were willing to split the baby this way. They were going to say they didn't really like Donald Trump. They didn't approve of much of his behavior. They didn't like the way he had gone about winning the nomination, all of that. But what they liked was the idea that if he became president, he would sign their bills that Barack Obama has been vetoing. And he would appoint someone to the Supreme Court to take the place of Antonin Scalia, who would be a Republican, presumably, or certainly somebody that they would like better than anybody that Hillary Clinton would appoint. And that, I think, applied to a lot of the voters as well.
NPR's Ron Elving, lots more to come. Thanks for your analysis, as always. And if you want to know more about what's happening in your state, even down to the county-by-county level, check out npr.org, where you can see detailed results. You're listening to live special coverage of the election 2016 from NPR News.
Ari Shapiro in Washington, 11:15. I'm Tom Cran in St. Paul with our political editor, Mike Mulcahy, as we continue our coverage tonight. So far, no declaration of our 10 electoral votes. They have not been projected for either candidate, but we do have some results in our House races in the U.S. Congress.
Right, and we have results in the presidential race, too. We just don't know who the winner is.
That's 70%, exactly right.
70% of the precincts reporting Hillary Clinton with a 49 to 43% lead in Minnesota over Donald Trump. And those congressional races, very interesting, Tom. Very interesting. We know that Eric Paulson has won, the incumbent Republican. We know Betty McCollum and Keith Ellison have won. We know that Tom Emmer has won. But then you look at some of these other districts. Let's look at the first district. That's where Democrat Tim Walz is the incumbent. He's currently up about 2,500 votes over Jim Hagedorn, his Republican challenger, with 78% of the precincts reporting. So a very tight race there, almost tied in the first district. That is unexpected. In the second district, that's another one of those tightly contested races, 33% of the precincts reporting now. Jason Lewis at 47%. He's the Republican. Angie Craig at 45%. And Paula Overby, the Independence Party candidate, at 8% in that open district.
Right.
And then finally, in the 8th district, 55% of the precincts reporting, Rick Nolan with just a slim lead over Stuart Mills. Rick Nolan, the incumbent Democrat, 52%. Stuart Mills, the Republican, 48% in the 8th district right now.
We're going to check in with our reporters who are at party headquarters in the Twin Cities Metro. And first to Tim Pugmire, who's with the Republicans in Bloomington. Tim, tell us what's going on there tonight.
Well, Tom, right now, the deputy chair of the Minnesota Republican Party, Chris Fields, is at the podium trying to give a little pep talk to the crowd here that grew a bit quiet over the last 20 minutes or so. I think there's a lot of anticipation among the folks of the crowd. Still a big crowd here in the ballroom, just waiting for that magic 270 number to appear on the television screens for Donald Trump, and then burst into celebration at that point. We haven't heard from anyone else at the stage since Congressman Eric Paulson delivered some remarks celebrating his re-election victory. I talked to him briefly afterwards, and he is very keen on getting to work as soon as possible on health care reform, taking on Obamacare and finding some alternatives as part of the House majority.
All right. Tim Pugmire with the Republicans tonight in Bloomington. Thank you very much. And Brian Baxt is with the DFLers there in downtown Minneapolis at the Hilton. And different mood there, I suspect, Brian.
Yeah, the crowd is thinning quite a bit. There's despondency all around. People are consoling each other that they know that the things aren't looking all that well. I spoke with a couple women who were on the way out, and they said that they were scared about what would happen. There just was a cheer because Minnesota came up, and it showed she's ahead, but it still hasn't been called. But there are quite a few people who just are talking amongst themselves about what to expect, how to tell their family members, and what to, how to talk about it at home.
All right. Brian Baxt, we'll continue to watch those numbers nationally as they come in and are tighter than we expected congressional races, Mike.
Right. And we're also watching the battle for control of the Minnesota legislature. Right now, the Republicans control the House. The Democrats control the Senate. And haven't called a lot of these races, but our two analysts, Maureen Shaver, the Republican, Todd Rapp, the Democrat, are getting some numbers from the campaigns. Maureen, what are you seeing out there?
Well, we're seeing what's happening in Minnesota is happening across the country is happening in Minnesota. I can give some quick overviews. In Red Wing, incumbent Matt Schmidt has lost to Mike Goggin. In the Owatonna-Faribault area, Vicki Jensen, the incumbent, has lost to Republican John Jasinski. Up in the Blaine-Champlin area, Senator John Hoffman, a Democrat, has won re-election. Out in Terry Bonoff's seat, the Senate seat that was in the Democrat column is now in the a Republican column to Paul Anderson.
Well, Todd, let me ask you very quickly, what's happening here?
Well, turnout looks solid to strong, so I think what's happening is, and we have a lot yet to find out, is that Donald Trump's poll in greater Minnesota has been more significant than Hillary Clinton's poll in the metro area.
All right, and we will continue to monitor things here in the state of Minnesota and nationally as we bring you Election Night 2016 live coverage on Minnesota Public Radio News.
From NPR News, this is special coverage of the 2016 election. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. While the presidential race continues to be tight, Donald Trump has been leading in the Electoral College vote all night. Donald Trump picked up Iowa, meaning his lead is now 244 in Electoral College votes to Hillary Clinton's 209. There are still a few states left, including Pennsylvania and Michigan.
And Republicans appear to be doing well in their push to keep control of Congress. Democrats were able to defend the U.S. Senate seat in Nevada, with Democrat Kathleen Cortez Masto winning the seat that Senator Harry Reid is vacating. That's according to the Associated Press.
And in Vermont, the Associated Press is projecting that Republican Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott has won that governor's race. Vermont, of course, is more known for its left-leaning tendencies. Let's talk about some of the key takeaways. And I guess one of the key takeaways is that the polls were very, very wrong. Leading up to the election, Hillary Clinton led in nearly every swing state. She led in nearly every national poll. And yet, Asma Khalid, Donald Trump is carrying one swing state after another tonight. We don't know why the polls were wrong, but can you offer some possibilities?
That's right. And I mean, look, I think there's a couple of key possibilities. And I should say we don't know, and we likely will not know the answer until some of the pollsters themselves have a sort of autopsy to figure out what happened and what went on. But one theory is that some of the people who were called just, look, weren't honest with the pollsters themselves. And I say that partly, I mean, if we look at one key demographic that looked like it was going to go for Hillary Clinton, our white college-educated voters. This was a group that had consistently been trending more towards Hillary Clinton in the national exit polls we have so far. Again, I'm relying on a poll, the national exit polls. It looks like Donald Trump won this group by about 4 percentage points. So that's one theory.
This is actually something that Kellyanne Conway, Trump's campaign manager, said on the air, was that people might have been embarrassed to admit they were voting for Trump.
Yeah, and it's a possibility. I mean, look, the other possibility is that maybe even within the modeling itself, it didn't account for what the electorate would look like. We may actually just have a larger percentage of white working class voters who participated today.
So just to be clear, pollsters actually adjust. They might get a group of 100 people that includes 60 white people, but if white people they think will actually be 55% of the voting population, they'll de-emphasize the weight of that group.
And
in
they
their
wait,
poll.
You know, say yeah. Latinos to be X percentage and whatnot. So it just could be that, you know, that there was not the correct modeling. And then the other theory is just that, you know, within the sort of plethora of polling is that, you know, there was sort of a herd mentality and no one pollster wanted to be the outlier.
Ron Elving, Hillary Clinton's campaign was banking on the fact that they thought they were going to get college educated Americans, but in particular, white women with college degrees.
Overall, college educated people voted for Hillary Clinton by a small margin. But if you take away from that group all the people of color who have college degrees, and you leave just the white people. Women still voted very narrowly, I think 51% as a majority for Hillary Clinton. But the men were another story. The men were voting for Donald Trump. Now, is it possible that because so much was said characterizing the Donald Trump vote as coming from people without college degrees, people who were, quote, blue collar, people who were disaffected. Is it possible that people talking to pollsters, possibly even exit pollsters, did not want to be so characterized because they thought of themselves as of another class, a college educated, more affluent class, and so they didn't own up to their intention to vote for Donald Trump? Or did they just somewhere along the line change their mind?
Yeah.
Or does it have something to do with the gender of the Democratic candidate?
Sue Davis, you have an update?
The seat of Nevada has been called for Hillary Clinton, and its 6 electoral votes will go to her. She now has 215 electoral votes to Donald Trump's 244. As you said, Rachel, they also elected Kathleen Cortez Masto, a Democrat in the open seat race there. Nevada is a rare bright spot for Democrats in the elections tonight.
So with that, can you just reset for us and lay out what are the two paths? What is the path for Donald Trump and what is the path for Hillary Clinton?
At this point, the path for Donald Trump is clearer, in part because he is currently leading by as many as 4 points in Wisconsin. And if Donald Trump wins Wisconsin, Hillary Clinton's path to the White House is
Ron Elving is waving in the if she holds on to Wisconsin and wins Pennsylvania and New Hampshire and the remaining states that are still out, that is her path. But Wisconsin, if that goes, there is no path for Hillary Clinton.
We should also be clear that while we have not called Wisconsin, as we've mentioned a few times tonight, Fox News has. We wait on the Associated Press, which is not prepared to make the call. We're going to go now to NPR's Elsa Chang, who is in Nevada at the Democratic Party event there, the Aria Hotel, one of the bright spots for Democrats on a night that doesn't have too many of them, Elsa.
It's been a weird mood in this room. There's been a lot of cheering because of, you know, the results for Clinton and for Catherine Cortez Masto, but there's a lot of nerves in this room right now, a lot of nervousness. You know, this Senate seat is a hold for Democrats. Remember, it's not a gain in a Senate seat. It's still great news. It is the Senate seat that Harry Reid, the outgoing Democratic leader in the Senate, has occupied for 30 years. It was the only Senate seat Republicans had a shot at flipping this election, and to do it with Harry Reid's seat in particular made it an especially meaningful battle, but they came up short. They did have a very strong candidate, Republican Congressman Joe Heck. He's a three-term congressman, a doctor, a brigadier general in the Army Reserve, but he just couldn't get the job done. His opponent, Democrat Catherine Cortez Masto, she was Harry Reid's hand-picked successor. So she enjoyed his muscular ground operations here, his Harry Reid machine. She's a former Nevada State Attorney General, and she has a particularly compelling profile for Hispanic voters in this state. She will be the first Latina in the U.S. Senate. Her grandfather emigrated to the U.S. from Chihuahua, Mexico. It's something that she talks a lot about, or talked a lot about, on the campaign trail. And so, yes, this is one bright spot for Democrats tonight in an otherwise cheerful but very still nervous room.
Elsa, stay with us. Sue Davis has a bit more news. Sue, what's up?
More good news for Republicans this evening. The Associated Press projects that House Republicans will hold on to their majority, which they took over in 2010, extending that six-year lock on the chamber. Democrats are now forecast to gain just single digits.
That's the House of Representatives. And Elsa, you're looking at Senate races not only in Nevada but across the country, where Democrats had maybe hoped to regain the majority from Republicans, but it looks increasingly unlikely as the night goes on.
Yeah, very, very dicey. I mean, the only seats Democrats can flip
Of a big cheer there going up behind you.
Oh, they just rebroadcasted the Senate results for Catherine Cortez Masto.
Bring it back
again. They cheer when they can cheer. You know, yes, Democrats have gained Illinois, and the only seats that they have left to possibly flip are New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, and Missouri. So at this point, theoretically, I guess the best case scenario would still be a Clinton White House, but a 50-50 Senate. And I mean, in the way this night is going, that's looking less and less likely.
This has been looking like something of a Republican wave night, to the surprise of many people. But it was supposed to be a year when the map favored Senate Democrats. If the Democrats were ever going to take back the Senate, this was the year to do it. What went wrong?
Well, I'm talking to the voters here, there is a lot of blame for the Clinton letter from James Comey, the FBI director.
They blame
a lot
the
of
FBI
people are
director.
Talking about tonight, yes, that last minute sort of supposed reopening of the investigation into the Clinton emails, and then a never mind last minute letter saying, you know, it wasn't the case that those emails were relevant or in any way determinative or dispositive. A lot of people here are laying blame for that. As to explain why this night has turned out or is turning out the way it is. I've also heard a lot of people blame us in the media that we didn't do a good enough job of vetting Trump at the beginning. And that's kind of what's happened. He's gained a lot of momentum early on that he never lost throughout this entire election. There's a lot of anger in this room, actually, at the press here tonight in the Democratic headquarters.
All right. And NPR's Elsa Chang speaking with us from Las Vegas, Nevada. Thanks, Elsa.
You're welcome.
Ron Elving, you know, something I'm still confused about. We have a lot of questions, but this is one that's on my mind right now. It appears, I mean, if we can make an assumption, if there is a Republican wave, if Republicans have now, we can affirm that they will hold the House, if they hold the Senate, if they take the White House. What about these Republicans who were so skittish about aligning themselves with Trump? Was that unnecessary? I mean, did they win because of him, despite him?
There are a great number of Republican intellectuals, people like George Will, who actually changed his party registration to leave the Republican Party. But a lot of other writers, a lot of other people who have published over the years, many of the major Republican or conservative news organs, and particularly magazines of opinion, separated themselves from Donald Trump almost immediately, were against him all the way through, did not endorse him in the fall. But the dynamic of this race was that Donald Trump emerged in a huge field of candidates, 17 candidates, with maybe a third to a 40% of the Republican vote, but outlasted all of his other rivals. And once he did that, then he piled up a lot more of the vote in the late primaries, emerged at the convention completely unchallengeable because at that point he had about half the delegates in his corner, and he was clearly the only option. And after that, once he was the Republican nominee, he was to some degree normalized. He became another Republican nominee. And while a lot of the conservative intellectuals didn't like that or rejected that, and much of the Republican establishment, including many senators, rejected him, something like a fifth to a fourth of all Republican office holders nationwide actively separated themselves from him. Very unusual behavior for Republicans. But by and large, the Republican electorate, people who ever vote Republican, came around and said, well, on the other hand, if we have Donald Trump, we have the White House, the Senate, we have the House, we have the key vote on the Supreme Court to keep a conservative majority there. That's not such a bad world in comparison with having Hillary Clinton. So they voted for the Republican nominee, love him or not.
Ron, we know what a typical Republican administration in waiting might look like. Donald Trump is not a typical Republican. What would we imagine a Trump cabinet to possibly look like?
There have been a lot of theories already advanced that the people who have been his surrogates, and he has not had a large cast of surrogates by any means.
Talking about Jeff Sessions, Chris Christie, Rudy Giuliani.
That's right. Now, Chris Christie has some legal problems of his own going back to Bridgegate. Some of his associates have been found guilty in a trial in New Jersey, so he may be a little problematic, but he has been the person in charge of the transition team for the Trump campaign. And not a lot of people were paying a lot of attention to that transition team, but they will be tomorrow. Mm. And Rudy Giuliani is certainly a very strong prospect to be attorney general or something of that nature. We have heard Newt Gingrich's name mentioned to have a cabinet position in the top level of cabinet positions. And some of the other people who have been involved, Jeff Sessions, the senator, and possibly also Kellyanne Conway, the campaign manager, perhaps Steve Bannon, some of the other people who have been powerful, the CEO of his campaign, Steve Bannon, the publisher of Breitbart.com, might have a cabinet-level role.
Now, Breitbart is an organization that has trafficked in the kinds of conspiracy theories and outright falsehoods that were once sort of relegated to the fringes. And through Donald Trump, a lot of those sort of conspiracy theories and falsehoods entered the mainstream. Does that, if Donald Trump becomes president, become, I don't know, U.S. administration policy?
At least it becomes, in a sense, mainstream, does it not? I mean, if the media organizations that did support Donald Trump have supported the man who will now be president, if that is the case, then are they then not, in some sense, mainstream organs of the media? When people talk about the media doing their job or not doing their job, the first question to ask is, which media are you talking about? It's a much more varied cast than it used to be or than most people realize.
What would Trump's first 100 days look like? Because he's quick with a good quip and has got really strong rhetoric. There hasn't been a lot of meat on the bone when it comes to policies. And before I get your answer, Sue, Dave, did you want to respond to that, Sue?
I just had a thought on that, because one thing that I've been thinking about throughout the course of this night, too, is two of the bets that Donald Trump made was that the white vote would turn out for him and that traditional Republicans would come home. And I think we've seen that traditional Republicans did come home. And one of the things that I heard throughout this election year, one issue that came up a lot was the Supreme Court. And the next president is going to certainly have one, if not three, vacancies to fill. And that was something that more traditional Republican voters, we heard earlier this evening talking about evangelical voters, that was a significant motivating factor for voting for Donald Trump, in part because he put out a list of justices or potential justices that he would nominate, including people like Mike Lee, the senator from Utah, who won his own reelection tonight. So the first 100 days of the next Congress, at least I can tell you, is going to be consumed by a Supreme Court nomination.
And, you know, it's interesting. When I've talked with Trump supporters, a lot of them cited the Supreme Court. I mean, I think it was perhaps underestimated how people who may not have college degrees, are very attuned to this and understand the significance of the court, and that was motivating a lot of people's votes. We are getting analysis and breaking news as we get it to you. You are listening to special coverage of Election 2016. You can follow us on Facebook, on Twitter, our live blog at npr.org. There's still much more to come. Don't go anywhere.
And Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon joins us on the line now. He endorsed Bernie Sanders in the primary, but has been supporting his party's nominee, Hillary Clinton. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. Great to be with you.
As a senator, would you be able to work with a President Trump?
I tell you, I'm extremely concerned. His strategy of division and denigration, fear and smear, it's a strategy completely at odds with the core values that have permeated our country, where we have embraced diversity. I'm extremely worried. I'm extremely concerned.
And so where does that leave you if you wake up tomorrow morning and he is, in fact, the next president?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm going to be up all night paying attention, and I understand that it's not, the path doesn't look too good right now. But one of the things I'm very concerned about is the Supreme Court. This is, you've all been talking about, but what the Republicans have done is try to pack the Supreme Court from the ideological right, basically to keep Citizens United in place, which is all about dark money from billionaires and big corporations to create policy by and for the privileged and the powerful. And that's the opposite of what America is all about.
I hear.
And so we're in deep trouble if this court packing scheme of the Republicans succeeds.
I hear a lot of concern, perhaps some despair. But if Donald Trump wins, concern and despair will not get you through the next 4 years. What does?
Well, certainly to fight for the things that will make America actually work for working Americans.
So is there anything that you could imagine actually collaborating with a President Trump on?
There, you know, there are a number of issues that both candidates have talked about, and one of them, for example, is infrastructure, and that would be a good place to start. Let's take advantage of the opportunity we have right now, and the fact that we're spending less than any other developed democracy in terms of the percent of our GDP, and invest in our bridges, and our roads, and our electric grid. And maybe from that, we're working on that, we can find some other areas to partner in.
Though the presidential race is still too close to call, it is not looking like a great night for Hillary Clinton. What do you think she could have done differently?
Well, certainly the race hasn't been called, and there'll be plenty of time for pondering that question. I think she has worked very hard to bring together the different wings of the party, Bernie Sanders team, as well as her team, in terms of the platform, in terms of taking on global warming, certainly in terms of affordability of college. I think she did a lot right to pull people together, there isn't any piece that I would critique at this moment. Let's ponder it carefully if it comes to that.
Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio News as we bring you live coverage of Election Night 2016. I'm Tom Cran here with Mike Mulcahy, and we have some Minnesota numbers for you. Minnesota, as a block of 10 electoral votes, has not been declared. It has not been called yet.
Not yet. It's tightening, though, the races. About 74% of the precincts reporting now. Hillary Clinton with 48% of the vote. Donald Trump with 44%. They're about 100,000 votes apart right now, and still quite a few votes to be counted. So we'll see what happens there. Also, Tom, interesting results in the congressional races. We're still waiting for numbers in the 2nd District. Very slow to report. Only 34% of the precincts reporting. Jason Lewis, the Republican, there with the 47%. Angie Craig, the Democrat, 44%. In the 1st District, this was a race that I don't think anyone would have predicted would have been close. It's close. 81% of the precincts reporting. close to a tie. Tim Walz has just the narrowest lead. He's the incumbent, the Democratic incumbent. Let's see, what else do we have? How about 8th District?
Yeah.
63% of the precincts reporting. Rick Nolan, the Democratic incumbent, holding a lead, 52% to Stuart Mills, 48%. And we know that Eric Paulson, the Republican in the 3rd District, won tonight re-election fairly easily.
And that was a heavily watched race, and these races, especially the 8th and the 2nd and the 3rd, all expensive races as well. We'll continue to monitor things here in Minnesota and let you know numbers when they come in as we continue with our coverage.
From NPR News, this is special coverage of the 2016 election. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Rachel Martin. Republicans have clinched control of the House of Representatives and are inching toward a GOP clean sweep of Congress and the presidency, which would certainly be a historic upset, to
NPR's
say the least.
NPR's Sue Davis is still here in the studio with us. And Sue, where do things stand at the moment?
The three races that are obviously we're looking at closely right now is Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. All three of those races are too close to call, and they will be decisive in telling us who the next president is. Clinton is leading in Michigan and Pennsylvania, but her lead is narrow. In Pennsylvania, with 96% of the vote in, it is tied at 48, which is not a very good night for Hillary Clinton. This was a state that she was heavily favored to win. It's all about Wisconsin, it seems. Donald Trump is ahead of her by just 3 points with almost 90% of the vote in. If Donald Trump wins Wisconsin, he may be on a very smooth path to the 270 electoral votes he will need to win the White House.
And just, you know, as you look at the map, do we need to be discussing possible tied electoral college scenarios? Do we need to be discussing recount scenarios? Is that a path we should be worried about?
It does not yet seem like there will be a tie, but what it does seem like is that the vote will be incredibly close, that if Donald Trump wins, it may be with just 272 electoral votes. We've also seen, we don't know the full outcome of the House and Senate, but we know both chambers will be narrower in the next Congress. And what we are seeing tonight is an even more polarized and even more narrow country in terms of how it's represented in government.
So it doesn't matter who wins. It's going to be difficult for that person as the president to claim a mandate by himself or by herself. But Ron, if Donald Trump wins, he gets the House, he gets the Senate. He can change things. He can pass legislation.
He will have a situation very much like George W. Bush had in 2004 when he got reelected, had a Senate that was more Republican than it had been before that election, a House ditto, had a pretty good situation with respect to the Supreme Court, and would eventually get two opportunities to add very strong conservatives to that court, which he did do. So we're looking at a very much a 2004-type scenario. The next move that American politics made after 2004 was a Democratic bounce back in the 2006 midterm elections, much as after Barack Obama's smashing win in 2008, the next move American politics made was a bounce back for the Republicans in the midterm election. Not predicting what will happen in 2018, just saying that when we have had these big moments where one party winds up with all the levers all of a sudden and feels that from now on they're just going to be in charge of everything, it usually takes about 2 years for things to change.
Is it worth taking a step back to remember that it would have been very unusual for Hillary Clinton, understanding the race is not over, but it would have been a third term, essentially, an extension of two Democratic presidencies, two Democratic administrations. That would have been a big deal in and of itself. It is more natural for the other party to win.
Especially if people are telling you that they want change. And many Americans have been saying that all year long. The exit polls tonight, the first number that jumped out at me was, what was your number one reason for the vote that you cast for president? 38%, by far and away the plurality of the four choices, said, I want to bring a change. I want a candidate who will bring a change. Now, how many of those people turned out to be Hillary Clinton voters? Probably not too many, and many of them were obviously Trump voters, and he got a share of the other three reasons as well.
And we have with us on the line now Mike Murphy, who is a Republican strategist who was a big Jeb Bush supporter, not a big fan of Donald Trump. Mike Murphy, welcome back to the program.
Hello.
Explain what's happening in your party.
Well, this is something else. It caught just about every professional in both parties flat-footed. Trump was able to get a huge vote in some areas, kind of asymmetrical, and Hillary underperformed. So that's leading to places like Wisconsin, which isn't called yet, but Trump has advantages. And the state Republicans have not won since 84. Down ballot, Republicans are doing well, not only in the Senate races, but Michigan, for example, another too close to call state. We're having an incredibly good time in the state House races there, winning a lot of races in tough areas. So there has been no doubt a huge Republican wave that Donald Trump, we can argue whether he's leading it or riding it, but that's what's happening, a rejection of Washington politics, a rejection of Hillary Clinton, and far more of an embrace of Donald Trump than I think any of us who are looking at the polling data and the other kinds of data we've used successfully for so many decades in politics would have believed. So we're kind of stunned by this.
You know, Mike, you preach a political gospel that says you have to have a data analytics department, you have to have a get out the vote operation, you have to have a big advertising budget. Donald Trump did none of those things. So are you now tearing up the book? What do you make of all this?
Well, it's something. I mean, I'm like a doctor. All of a sudden, penicillin doesn't work anymore. So I don't want to abandon our stuff. I know a lot of what drove this Trump thing is there's such an anti-DC, anti-politics, and to some extent anti-democratic wave in the country. It was able to lift up the imperfect candidate of Donald Trump and let him loose. And Trump, frankly, unleashed some racial stuff that got him some votes. You know, a dialogue we haven't heard in politics, the subtext, at least, of a lot of things he was saying about Latinos and the wall and everything. So, you know, I don't want to throw out the playbook that's worked, but we got to reexamine it because this is an unexpected wave here, and it's very powerful.
Earlier this evening, we heard Mara Liasson say that she had talked to a lot of Republicans who privately told her they thought it would be better for the GOP if Donald Trump lost than if Donald Trump won. Now that we're looking at the real possibility of a Donald Trump victory, do you think this is a good or bad thing for the GOP?
Well, it's beyond that. We're looking at what could be a ton of success at every level on a ticket led by Donald Trump. Now, good or bad thing for the Republican Party is an open question. It's a good thing in that we won a lot of elections, and our senators worked really hard to, you know, win their own races. But it's a good thing in the scorekeeping. What Donald Trump means now, because he's very flexible. What Trump 3.0 will be, should he be president, is an open question. That could be good for the GOP if Trump evolves into something a little different than what we saw in the campaign trail.
Why should he evolve into something different? He's on a Republican wave.
Well, that's the argument he'll make. He'll say, what I was selling, the country wanted. Now, I think Hillary Clinton was part of that equation. No doubt there's a rejection of her and kind of normal, you know, institutional democratic politics. But
you know,
he'll be able to say, I'm not changing a thing.
It seems to me for the last year and a half, people have continued to predict that Donald Trump will just
change
of his own accord, or someone will force him to change,
right,
or moving
has.
From a primary to a general election, or now from a general election to potentially a White House if he wins. He's shown no evidence, no indication that he has any inclination or reason to change.
No, that's not what I'm arguing. You asked me if it was a good or bad thing for the party, and I said beyond scorekeeping, on kind of a moral question of what we believe in,
yeah,
he would have to change for me to think it's a good thing, because what he ran on, I don't believe.
Well,
but
so
in terms of winning elections this year, what he ran on worked for him with a little assist from Hillary just fine.
So if he shows that Republicans can win national elections by racially charged dialogue and, you know, comments that may be considered demeaning to women, et cetera, it's still winning elections.
I agree. That it makes the argument against that thing a lot harder, because people in politics tend to accept what works. But I think there will be a pushback, and there are going to be other power centers in the party that have concerns about Donald Trump as president. So there's a lot more discipline required in the Oval Office than on the campaign trail.
So as you look at this wave, with the party that you love and support having victories across the board, and this man who you neither love nor support leading it, on the whole, how do you feel?
Happy for the Senate and House, and depressed about Trump as president. Hmm.
Republican strategist Mike Murphy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We've got a lot of questions, and we're going to take a few minutes to try to get to the bottom of one of them, which is, why were so many polls so wrong? We have reached Sean Trende. He's the senior elections analyst for Real Clear Politics. Sean, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
What happened?
Well, we're still trying to sift through that. I actually had a series of tweets I put out on Friday about the possibility of poll failure. And one thing I found, we'll have to look at the data to see if this holds up, but the poll failures in 2014 were correlated with the share of the white working class vote in the state. I don't know if that's going to be the case this way, but I think that's probably going to be part of the answer, that pollsters just didn't get enough white working class voters. They maybe had too many non-white voters in their samples.
So are these people who have not typically been politically engaged? Are they first-time voters? Was this a secret Trump vote?
Well, I think part of it is probably going to be new voters. Again, we'll have to wait and look at the data. I think part of it, though, is that the Democrats have been very much focused on this kind of new coalition, what Ron Brownstein calls the coalition of the ascendant. And I think they forgot that whites without college degrees are a near majority of the electorate. And if they lose even 5% more of those voters, it causes real problems for them, at least in the short term.
Are you surprised right now? I mean, what were your predictions going into this night?
I thought that, well, I said there was about a 1 in 3 chance that Trump would win. I was on Team Nate Silver. And then when I got the early returns, I thought it was over and Clinton had won. And I said so, and then I had to walk that back.
So Mara Liasson, who's in the studio right now, has a question for you, Sean.
Hi, Sean. It's Mara Liasson. I was just struck by something you said. You said white non-college are a majority of the electorate. I thought that they were a majority in states like Wisconsin and Michigan, where Trump appears to have won, but not in the electorate. They're like 35% now, I thought.
No. I didn't mean to say, if I said majority, I misspoke. I meant to say near majority, because they're over 40% of the national electorate.
But, you know, the narrative going into this election was that Donald Trump couldn't win with just white people, that the Republican Party and Donald Trump in particular had to do a better job of reaching out to minority voters and women. How is what we're seeing right now reflective of that?
Well, you know, I've always said that there were two paths for the GOP. And I should say that, kind of echoing Mike Murphy, from a moral standpoint, I think outreach is necessary and good. But, you know, whites are still 70% of the electorate. And so if you run up the score, then you're going to win a lot of elections in the short term. Again, the strategy versus morality, kind of two different things. The other thing is that the non-white vote is kind of inefficiently distributed. It's not in a lot of the electoral heavy states, whereas as we're seeing tonight, in a lot of these heavy white states like Iowa and Wisconsin and Michigan, Pennsylvania, the white vote's really important. It's hard to talk about it that way because, like I said, I think we have a moral responsibility to represent all Americans. Country. But from a strategy standpoint, it seems to have worked, although the exit polls also showed Donald Trump doing about as well as Mitt Romney with non-whites. We'll see if that holds up.
What's the takeaway for you as a professional when it comes to reading these polls as we move forward?
Well, I think what people forget about polls is that there's error margins, but then there's modeling error. Like at a certain point at the end of the day, pollsters have to make assumptions about what they think the electorate's going to look like. And those assumptions, if they're just off, then the polls are going to be off and there's really nothing you can do about it. You know, it does happen. We had two really good presidential elections in 2008 and 2012 for polling. People have forgotten the years that we miss.
Is there any precedent for this? I mean, can you conjure up another example of when the polls have been so wrong?
Well, in a presidential year, there have been poll errors of about 2 or 3 points before, but never that caused an election to be called wrongly. Even in like 1996, the national polls showed Clinton winning by high double digits and he only won by 9 points. That was a huge miss, but it didn't matter because everyone said he was going to win. This time it mattered.
Sean Trende is a senior elections analyst for Real Clear Politics. Thanks so much, Sean.
Thank you.
Ron, you were shaking your head. You heard what Sean was saying. It made sense to you.
Yes, of course it does. And of course, we have to say that we really don't have an answer for why the polls were off, not by a point, not by 2 points, but apparently by something like 5 or 6 points in terms of the national popular vote, and particularly in terms of the state votes. We're still not calling Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, but those are 3 states that the Democrats have counted on going back to the first Bill Clinton election in 1992. What we tend to forget, and what I think Sean was hinting at here, was that, and actually Mike Murphy was talking about this too, that many of those times that those 3 states went with the Democrats in those elections since 1992, the margin was actually quite close, especially in Wisconsin. There have been some real cliffhangers in Wisconsin that went the Democrats' way. And then, of course, people just go, well, you know, Wisconsin always goes with the Democrats. Michigan always goes with the Democrats. They don't stop and look at just how narrow that margin was. And this year, something came loose. It came loose among white voters, primarily non-college, but college as well, especially men.
It is a historic election, perhaps historic in a way many thought was not going to be the case. You are listening to special coverage of election 2016 here on NPR News.
Rachel Martin in Washington with Ari Shapiro tonight. I'm Tom Cran, Minnesota Public Radio News, as we continue with our coverage news just in the last few minutes that the one amendment on the ballot statewide, the legislative pay amendment, has passed easily. So now an independent commission will be established to set legislators' salaries. They haven't been raised since 1999. Also, Supreme Court Justice Natalie Hudson is leading the race against challenger Michelle McDonald. That race has not yet been called. I'm Tom Cran here with our political editor, Mike Mulcahy, and we have our eye on those House races that are still not called.
We have our eye on a couple of things that haven't been called, including control of the legislature. Who might get those raises if that independent panel decides to give legislators a raise? But let's start, Tom, with the presidential race in Minnesota, which hasn't been called yet. Hillary Clinton is leading 48-44 over Donald Trump. It's about an 85,000 vote margin that Hillary Clinton has right now, with 77% of the precincts reporting. And I think what we're seeing is Donald Trump running very strong in rural Minnesota, and that is having an impact on some of these congressional races.
Right.
When you look in the first district, that's the southern tier of counties, and it goes into Rochester and Mankato. Tim Walz, the DFL opponent, who I don't think anyone really predicted was going to have a tough race, is in a very tough race. He's 50-50 with his Republican opponent, Jim Hagedorn, and about 2,600 votes ahead right now. So we're keeping an eye on that one. In the 7th district, that's the western part of the state, all the way up to the Canadian border, Colin Peterson, longtime DFL incumbent, the longest-serving member of the Minnesota House.
That's right.
He is in a pretty tight race with Dave Hughes, the Republican, 76% of the precincts reporting. Peterson has 52% and Hughes has 48%. That's about a little less than 11,000 vote difference.
Mm-hmm.
So we're keeping an eye on that one. Now, we were talking about these competitive races, and we know that Eric Paulson won in the 3rd District. We know that the votes are very slow in coming in the 2nd District. Jason Lewis, the Republican, has a lead there, but we're still waiting for a lot of votes to be counted. In the 8th District, that other competitive district, this one north and east of the Twin Cities up to the Canadian border, Rick Nolan has a lead over Republican Stuart Mills. Nolan, the DFL incumbent, 52-48 right now. And Dan Crocker sent us some information that Donald Trump is running 12 points ahead of Hillary Clinton in the 8th district.
In that district, yeah.
And Rick Nolan, the Democrat, is still holding a 4-point lead over Stuart Mills.
And that's with what about how was
68% of the precincts in on that one. And so let's bring Todd Rapp and Maureen Shaver in quickly here and talk about this. Todd, let me start with you. What do you make of how strong Trump has run in rural Minnesota, and what are the implications of that for some of these other races?
Well, he's winning the first congressional district by more than a 2-to-1 margin. You see that, those kind of numbers, and I guess it's not surprising that Tim Walz is in the fight of his political life there. What I'm seeing is that in most rural districts, Trump and the other Republican candidates are running very close to each other. In the suburbs, it's more of a mixed message. In Anoka County, they're running close together. In suburban Hennepin, and Washington counties, Trump is running well behind a lot of Republican candidates. So he's got pull in some parts of the state, but not all of them.
But it's looking like a good night for Republicans in Minnesota.
It seems that way. It looks like the Senate's going to be very, very close, a seat or two each way. Most people over at the House are now saying that they've got the House Republicans have 68 seats, and there's 7 or 8 left to go.
That's Todd Rapp on Minnesota Public Radio News. This is Minnesota Public Radio News, 91.1 KNOW, Minneapolis, St. Paul. Listener-supported radio. With more news anytime and election results galore at nprnews.org. Right now, we can say that in District 3, U.S. House District 3, Eric Paulson has won another term. He defeated Terry Bonoff 57-43%. Betty McCollum has won another term in St. Paul, in District 4, mostly St. Paul, with 58% of the vote. And Keith Ellison has been reelected in District 5, Congressional District 5. That's mostly Minneapolis and parts of Hennepin County. Tom Emmer has won reelection in the 6th District. We're still watching results in the 8th. Here we are, late in an election night, looking at 8th district results. But right now, Rick Nolan ahead 54% to Stuart Mills' 46%, only 35% in. 11 o'clock at Minnesota Public Radio News.